Welcome to What Matters in North Carolina. This week, we'll speak with Francis DeLuca, president of the Civitas Institute, about a recent article he wrote on voter ID. Then we'll speak with Dr. Robert Lipke and Demi Dowdy, also of the Civitas Institute, about what's going on in the legislature with education and also in the budget. Then we'll speak with Susan Myrick and Jim Tynan about voter election fraud reporting and how the left is using the courts to deter citizens from reporting possible voter fraud. So now let's move right in and hear from Civitas President Francis DeLuca.
This is Francis DeLuca, the president of Civitas. And earlier this month, the Supreme Court of the United States denied North Carolina its day in court to defend its new election law that was passed in 2013. It's disappointing, but it's not the end of the world. There is a way forward, and today, actually, the situation is no different than it was yesterday, than it was in April last month, or even on Election Day of 2016. So we need to take a quick look at the current landscape and where we are. For Democrats and Republicans, the electoral field has not changed. Under the current rules, Democrats, except for the governor's race, were the big election losers in North Carolina in 2016. Despite the cries of gerrymandering by the losers, many of these elections have nothing to do with gerrymandering or electoral redistricting. They have everything to do with their candidates getting fewer votes than the Republican candidates. The Democrats are in the minority on the Council of State in North Carolina for the first time ever. Republican control, more county commissions, and more elected county commissioners than any time in recent history. The Republicans will control both U.S. Senate seats for at least the next 4 years. This is the first time that's happened since the 1990s. And despite predictions of widespread legislative losses for the GOP, the partisan makeup of the state legislature remains the same. Democrats picked up one seat in the House. Republicans picked up one seat in the Senate. So in both legislative bodies, the Republicans maintain supermajorities that they can override the governor vetoes if they so desire to. So while most Democrats celebrated the high court's decision and most Republicans bemoaned it, there really seems to be no political gain for Democrats and really no political damage for the Republicans under the current rules. It's, again, looking at electoral history, this ruling by the Supreme Court earlier in May should have no impact on the races. In fact, one could argue that Republicans benefit more under the current rules than they would under a change, because we don't know what will happen under a change. But, you know, so I want to make sure, and I talked earlier about the gerrymandering and everything and legislative redistricting. You can only do that on legislative seats and seats that have a geographical boundary that is not contiguous with an entire state or county. And that's why I pointed out the makeup of the county commissions. A lot of those are countywide seats. Also, the Council of State is a statewide. You can't gerrymander a statewide election, and Republicans are winning at higher levels. So, like I said, Republicans, if they just stayed right where they were and did not change the election rules, it looks like things are favoring them. But winning and doing the right thing are not the same. While Republicans are winning, the right thing to do is make sure that our citizens trust the electoral system. As Civitas polling has consistently shown, voters support measures that instill more confidence in the electoral system. In other words, some common sense things like voter ID, restrictions on same-day voting, same-day registration, things like that, give them more confidence that the election outcomes are, in fact, legitimate. When it comes to voting elections, there are many legislative actions that should be taken, but I'm just going to talk about photo ID, because the legislature needs to again pass a comprehensive voter ID, which they had in the other bill, which got struck down by courts and that the Supreme Court has not actually reviewed. This should be accomplished this year in 2017 in one of two ways. In other words, the current legislature needs to pass a voter photo ID law requiring a government-issued photo ID. This ID requirement should cover all forms of voting, so we treat all voters equally. In other words, you should have to show an ID to vote in person. You should have to show some form of ID to vote absentee. You should have to show some form of ID to vote by mail. You know, absentee voting is kind of a benefit to people. It is not actually a requirement, and our one-stop voting is a form of absentee voting. Any government-issued photo ID should be accepted, but no private IDs, and that would include no private colleges. In other words, if you're attending a private school, you've got to get a government ID, a photo ID. As part of this effort, I think they should put photos on things like electronic benefits transaction cards, SNAP cards, all the things that are issued for what we commonly refer to as welfare. Maine has done this, actually. They are putting photos on these cards and make those acceptable forms of ID. Now, Maine does it in a voluntary way. People are asked if they want to put their photo on these cards. You know, and then they're issued. Those would then become valid. This would also remove some of the requirement, you know, in terms of, well, people can't afford it. If they're on a welfare program, they should be able, if they get that photo ID, there is no cost, and it further protects the welfare system from fraud. That's the added benefit of reducing fraud in the welfare system and giving them a free voter ID. Also establish the county boards of elections as issuing agencies for free photo IDs. In other words, they would set up with cameras and card systems to issue them. People go there to register. They could get their photo ID right at the same time. And they're, you know, we wouldn't need to make it based on income or anything. Just you basically, if they ask for it, you give it to them. The ideal of turning it over to the Department of Motor Vehicles, which they did in the 2013 law, turned out to be a disaster. The DMV could still issue free IDs, but they would not be the primary source. And if you're like me, you try and avoid going to the Department of Motor Vehicles at every chance you can. You don't want to deal with them. You want to do everything you can to avoid going in there. But that was one of the first places where the state had a problem with the last law, was that with DMV not giving people the free voter IDs. The other thing they could do would be just to take the Georgia law adopted in 2005, implemented in 2008, which has passed judicial muster. Take that law as it is and pass it intact. We previously here at Civitas advocated for this approach because we said if they've already done it, they've done the hard work of running this through the courts and everything and getting it all the way up to the Supreme Court. Don't monkey around with it. Just make it fit the North Carolina statutes and pass it. That would include adding County Board of Elections as agency that can issue free voter IDs. You know, when you look at Georgia, it's a state whose size and demographics are similar to North Carolina. It's about the same population-wise, about the same demographic makeup. It's a southern state. So why should North Carolina reinvent the wheel? Just copy what Georgia did. You know, there is a resistance among legislators to copying other states, but sometimes it's the best path. Either the above would likely trigger a lawsuit from the left almost immediately, which will start the path to again reaching the U.S. Supreme Court on the issue. This would be a clean voter ID case without the other issues and confusions that Chief Justice John Roberts used in his written decision in which the court dodged this last case. Really, they didn't rule that the voter ID was unconstitutional. They just basically didn't rule anything, which accepted the Fourth Circuit opinion. But now we have a split in the districts as other circuit court levels have decided that photo ID are constitutional. So if we can get another case working its way up, it'll be hard for the Supreme Court to duck this indefinitely. The North Carolina legislature needs to act now to start the inevitable legal proceedings that will follow. In conjunction with the law, the legislature needs to look at our state constitution. And this is serious. There have been rumblings about using state courts to thwart voter ID, and the legislature should look at putting an amendment on the ballot in either 2018 or 2020 to make it crystal clear that voter photo ID is authorized by the North Carolina Constitution. Not required. I say authorized. Just a simple language that says any requirement for ID by the legislature for voting is not inconsistent with the Constitution. You get lawyers to write it up, but it's a very simple thing. You don't require it in the Constitution, but you make sure the Constitution cannot be used to prohibit it. It would protect our state's citizens' rights to a safe, secure election. In 2016, there was a case in state court about photo ID before Judge Mike Morgan. Now, he is Justice Morgan of the North Carolina Supreme Court. He was just a Superior Court judge. He's now a judge on the Supreme Court. So he's already started looking at the photo ID. But that issue became moot after the Fourth Circuit, the U.S. Fourth Circuit, struck down the law. But just because it's moot now doesn't mean that if a federal court in the future authorized us to issue photo voter ID, that somebody wouldn't file a case in state court again to have it ruled unconstitutional via the North Carolina Constitution. We need to make it crystal clear that there is no impediment in North Carolina requiring a photo ID for voting, and that North Carolina takes safeguarding the integrity of elections seriously. If you're interested in more on this topic and other things, you can get it at nccivitas.org. Thank you for listening.
The Civitas Institute Conservative Leadership Conference is June 16th and 17th. Nigel Farage, leader of the UK Independence Party in the face of Brexit, will headline this year's event. Incredible speakers, noted policy experts, and conservative leaders from across the country will come together to educate, equip, and inspire you to stand up for your freedoms. The 2017 Conservative Leadership Conference, June 16th and 17th at the Raleigh Marriott Crabtree Valley. Get details and tickets at civitasclc.com. That's CIVITASCLC.
Hi, this is Demi Dowdy. I'm Communications Coordinator at the Civitas Institute. And I'm sitting here with Dr. Robert Lipke, and he is going to be talking about education and the legislature. So we're going to discuss what do people need to know, what's up next, what do we need to watch out for, and what's the legislature been up to. Thanks for being here to talk about it.
It's good to be here, Demi. As you know, there's a lot going on in the legislature with education. That's always one of the main topics, and it's hard actually to keep track of everything, but today we're going to try to give you a handle on what's going on with some of the major legislation that I think people need to know about, and some of the main provisions in the budget bill. So just to get started, let's talk about some of the things that have already actually been passed in the legislature.
Okay.
And there's actually two bills that have impacted education. And the first one might not seem like a big significant bill to a lot of people, but it does have significance. It was a bill that actually decreased the size of the Board of Governors from 32 to 24 people. That didn't get a lot of play, but obviously if you're on the Board of Governors, which is a policymaking body, mm-hmm. which impacts the UNC system, it's important. And the rationale for that, and it seemed like people on both sides seemed to agree with this, that it was just simply too big to really be effective. So they passed that. Governor Cooper signed off on it. Really wasn't a lot of fanfare for it. The other bill, which was the class size bill, which I think a lot of people heard about because there was contention on both sides of that issue. People that were for it, people that were against it felt strongly about it. If you remember, ideally, at the end, they fashioned a compromise bill where schools will not have to abide by the new class ratios until next year. So they bought a year's time on it, basically. Now, why is that important to conservatives?
Great question.
To anybody who cares about education. If you look at how schools are funded in North Carolina, as they are in a lot of places, whether it be the local district or the state, oftentimes they provide money for teachers based on class ratios. In other words, like in the lower grades, the ratios are usually lower than what they are as say in junior high or high school. That impacts how many teachers a local school district has to hire. Okay, and for example, in the lower grades, it may be like one teacher for every 15 to 18 students. As you get up, it'll be one to every 21, 24, 27, you know, something like that. That's expensive. I mean, because you're hiring more teachers. Now, North Carolina has had these ratios in place for quite some time. Now, there's a lot of discussion still on the issues on whether or not we should even have them. I feel, and I've written about, that we kind of straitjacket ourselves when we basically cement our positions, you know, to these ratios. And oftentimes people who are in favor of these ratios, and there's somewhat of an intuitive appeal to it. Obviously, people think, well, if you have smaller classes, you know, in the lower grades, it's going to be better for kids.
Right.
You know, that,
I hear that a lot. Yeah.
That's understandable. And as you get older, you know, and as in certain subjects, you might not necessarily need to have small classes. You can, students can grasp the material. It's they don't require necessarily smaller classes.
Sure.
You know, in high school, etc. There's been a lot of research that's been done, and there's a lot of people who say that the argument is really not settled on this, that these class size ratios really produce higher student achievement. In fact, there's been a lot of research in the last 4 or 5 years that really say that the best indicator for student achievement is to put a high quality teacher in the front of the classroom.
Right, right.
And as conservatives, you know, we'd be obviously be in favor of that, but we should also be in favor of believing, as I do, that local school districts should be able to determine how many students should go in each class.
Right.
Of course, that doesn't mean that, you know, local officials would think, well, we're going to put 70 kids in a kindergarten or, you know, 85 in Mrs. Smith's second grade
Hopefully
class.
Not.
It's not going to happen. We trust, you know, local officials enough to know that they know how to manage those classes. And I always have felt, you know, offended, you know, that state officials don't have enough trust in local teachers and local superintendents to make those choices.
Right.
They'd trust us to make some other choices. But in a big choice like that, I think those decisions are best made by local officials who know the numbers that are needed, who know who the good teachers are,
right,
who can manage classes, things like that. And my bottom line on this is that there should be more flexibility for local local schools.
I agree. That's a very good point. Because intuitively, I think most would say a smaller class size is best for every classroom across the board.
That's right. And also, what happens as you end up hiring more teachers in this, inevitably, and especially in areas where there are teacher shortages or maldistributions of teachers, I would say, you end up hiring teachers that probably are less experienced and might have more of a problem teaching.
Sure.
So those that oftentimes are come up on the other side of this issue, there's a big thrust now that how do you boost student achievement? Traditionally, a lot of people have said, let's concentrate on class size. Now there's another stronger voice saying, well, we should really be focusing our attention on trying to raise the quality of the teachers in each classroom.
Huh, so that's very interesting.
That was a long-winded answer to it.
Yeah,
but,
no, that's interesting.
But that's kind of a window into the, you know, some of the issues in the class size issue.
So what are some of the objections from the other side?
On class size?
Yes.
Well, basically, they don't feel like we should have larger numbers in each class. Mm-hmm. That the more people you put in each classroom, the worse it is for each student.
Right, right.
Now, as I said before, I think you have to trust local officials.
Yeah.
They're not going to all of a sudden, you know, put 10 or 15 additional students in classes where it doesn't work. It's in everyone's best interest to make sure that students are learning. And teachers and principals and so forth, I think they will work within the best interests of what's good for students.
Right. Interesting.
So,
thanks. All right, well, moving on. What is some other legislation right now?
Yeah, some of the major legislation that is percolating, I guess, is the best word, because it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to.
That's right.
Some
we're
of it
still
will
waiting.
Be. We're waiting, and it might not finish or or be good when it's done. But
sure.
There's a lot of talk about changing the start and end times for school districts, school calendars. That's always come up. If you've, anybody who's been watching the legislature the last few years,
yeah,
that's always been a contentious issue. Basically, what are the issues there? Well, it's the vacation or tourism industry does not want to have start times for schools that go back into mid-August and so forth.
I see.
Feeling that they would lose a lot of workers and revenue.
Interesting.
Versus, the people who say, well, local districts should really determine what time schools start. And, you know, it's one of these classic issues where, you know, it's hard to come down on one side or the other without recognizing it seems like each side has a little merit. But what the big issue is here is, the reality is 65% of all funding for local schools comes from the state.
Yeah.
And ultimately, in the end, when that happens, they're the ones oftentimes that call the shots.
Yeah, sounds like it. What's in their best interest?
Yes, and you have to balance, you know, the interests of the local schools, which vary. I mean, the problem is when you have a state system like this, the interests of school districts down in like New Hanover County are not the same as, you know, Avery County,
sure,
way out
absolutely.
In the west. So how do you do what's best for all of those, you know, for the students concerned, for the local businesses? Mm-hmm. That's what the legislature has to struggle with.
Wow. Okay.
What else? We also have a school bond referendum that is likely.
How much is that one?
$1.9
billion. Oh, man.
It's likely to probably be passed.
Okay.
It's passed the House already. It is working its way through the Senate. But how that works is it will be put on as a school bond referendum on the November 2018 ballot.
Right, right.
The money will be targeted primarily for schools. Every school district will get money. But the formulas will be set up so fast growing school districts and school districts in economically depressed areas mm-hmm. will probably get more
okay.
money because of the needs involved.
Okay.
Why is this is interesting? For a number of reasons, one of which I would just basically say conservatives should watch this because the way we fund schools in North Carolina is like, it's like being a rat in a maze. It is very hard to figure out.
Yes.
It's very hard to figure out. Now, if you look, if you want to be, it looks on its face like it's very simple.
Right.
It says in state law that the state is responsible for instructional expenses.
Mm-hmm.
Local schools are the responsibility of the local counties. In other words, school construction costs.
Sure.
So you think if things stop there, okay, it's clear, pretty clear, isn't
right,
it?
Right.
Well, it does not work that way because you have money that the state has come in. They've had bond referendums. They've probably had 10 bond referendums since 1949 that have come in and were supposed to handle areas of great growth, you know, where there's been expansion. A lot of families have been moving in to kind of help localities with that. Okay, so that the last one we've had here has been 1996. It's been 21 years.
Mm-hmm.
So people that are in favor of this bond referendum say it's been 21 years since we've had it. You know, we've got a lot of this demand. The DPI says that there's $8 billion in capital in school construction capital costs that they're backlogged on.
Hmm.
You know, they need the money.
Right.
And, well, anybody who sits back and looks at that should say also, well, but school costs are primarily the responsibility of local communities. And if you look at the numbers they have, with the most recent data available, local communities have funded about 95% of these costs. But what's happening in some of these, in some of the areas of highest need, they are losing population. And some of these schools are quite old, and there's they don't have the tax base to actually even do a local, to raise local costs, to raise local taxes. It wouldn't raise enough. So some people say, well, this would help that. Yes, it probably would. There are some needs, but what I would favor also is just changing the way that we finance schools, because we say it's basically a local responsibility. Then we provide money like we've provided for, we've provided a portion of that corporate income tax, which we took away. We've said we're going to provide lottery money, which we have since 2006, but we've had that in declining amounts. It initially was 40% of lottery money in 2006 went for school local school construction costs. That number has come down like to like 17, 19, 20% in the last couple of years. Okay. So we say it's a local responsibility, but then we say we provide all these state programs, and then we take the money back. So it's a lot of haphazard actions that don't seem to move very well together.
Okay.
So
Bob, what's something may affect charter schools?
Yeah, charter schools are also, there's two pieces of legislation in the, actually two bills, two separate bills that have worked their way through the legislature.
Okay.
That one would allow municipalities to operate charter schools, and another would basically allow charters to expand more quickly, where that's been a problem because of the red tape, that if you... if you expand at a higher percentage, like 20 or 30% of what your normal enrollment growth is, there are a lot of things you have to do.
Right.
And there are two bills that I hope pass that would do those things. First, as I said, allow municipalities to operate charter schools, which I think would be a good thing.
Yeah.
They still have to report to the state board, but in a lot of states, outside of North Carolina, North Carolina has not actually done this much. They do have government entities, whether it be city governments or in some cases universities, that have operated charters quite successfully. So that would be a good thing to see in North Carolina.
Okay.
And also another provision that you might want to watch, or you'll probably hear about, our school performance grades that have changed. If you remember when this, these are the A, B, C, D, F grades that you heard about, that are oftentimes in the newspaper once or twice a year.
Yes.
The formula for those, without getting into a lot of detail, 80% of the formula is based on basically test scores, 20% on school growth grades. There's a lot of people that don't like those. There was a provision saying it should go to 50-50. There was a provision in the bill. There's also another bill that's working its way through, trying to tweak it as well. That's probably will be changed. That's applicable because it provides parents additional information. But one of the good things, people always will shout about, well, this isn't a good formula because of this, this, or this.
Right.
None of the formulas are going to be perfect. One of the good things from this whole idea of school performance grades is that oftentimes schools haven't liked this, but what they've done is they've showed parents other ways that their children are learning or progressing that they normally wouldn't have done. They're trying to defend or show parents basically areas where they've progressed or how schools are performing.
Sure.
We view that as a good thing.
Yeah.
You know, every indicator is going to have shortcomings. If schools want to come out and amplify and elaborate on other areas where they feel like they've progressed, that's a good thing.
Yes.
So.
Agreed. Okay. Well, Bob, Would you like to move on?
Yes. Why don't we? We haven't even hit the budget yet.
So, Bob, can you give us a quick overview of the budget? And I know a lot of our listeners are very passionate about school choice issues, as you are, and we'd love to hear how the budget will affect that.
Well, the budget, as everybody knows, it's an annual document. It's probably the biggest document that legislators produce. You can get lost in it. I don't want to get people lost in it.
There's a lot there.
Yeah, there's too much there for the average person. So my job, part of my job is to distill this out into the how it affects the average person. And let's just say right now what the legislature is doing is that they're dealing with two different budgets, a Senate and a House version. Mm-hmm. Basically, they're both the same numbers, $22.9 billion.
Wow.
When it's affected, how does that affect education? There's about a $300 million difference between the Senate and the House version. Okay, I don't want to get way down in the details on it, but the major difference is the Senate spends probably $300 million more. There's a difference. The major expenditures, the biggest provisions in the bills are with regards to teacher pay. That's what's going to probably cost the most money and probably impact the most number of people, whether you be a teacher, a student, a parent, et cetera. The House proposes a pay plan that teachers will get basically a 1% to a 6% pay raise based on the years of service. And the Senate proposes a plan basically that would be about a 4.8% average raise targeted on primarily people with probably 10 to 14 years of experience.
Okay.
So in smaller raises for people in other experience levels, but that's, you know, that's the basic, just basically 1% to 6% for House, about a 4.7 to 4.8 for the Senate. If you remember a while back, Governor Cooper, who was the first one to weigh in on this, suggested a 10% raise for teachers over two years.
Wow.
5% each year. So that costs about $810
million. Wow.
So the Senate and the House come in obviously a little lower than that, but the expectation and the assumption is that teachers will get a raise. It's just a matter of how large. What's also important in that is we're not only talking about teachers, but we're also talking about probably administrators and principals. Underneath those numbers, those large numbers, is also raises for administrators and teachers. If I remember my numbers correctly, there was the about $620 million of the 700 and some, the increase for the budget for the Senate was about $775 million. 600 of that went to the K-12, and the majority of that $618 million was for pay raises.
Okay.
So if you want to get a handle on numbers, the majority of the increases for any budget increase here for teachers, majority of that money is for pay raises.
Okay.
So that's where most of it's going. So what else is in the budget that we need to know about? Obviously, school choice provisions.
Yes.
There are a number of provisions with regards to the Opportunity Scholarship. The House came out with their budget plan, I believe it was yesterday, and they have suggested putting an evaluation on the existing program, working through a local research institute, and had requested that schools be required to take a standardized test for part of the research end of that. We don't oppose that. Obviously, we have to have accountability.
Sure.
The main concerns that we have there are that to make sure that institutional autonomy is protected, that schools still maintain control over their curriculum, over the program, et cetera. And so that's probably going to be an ongoing thing. The program itself, we're hoping will expand again because it's proven to be a very popular program.
Yes, it has.
The Senate The Senate has also included a provision for personal education savings accounts, which we were very happy to see, for a very small a program of about, the cost would be about $1 million.
Okay.
But it would be a start, and it would be a very good thing to for a lot of parents. It would be the eligibility for it would be for special needs students.
So can you explain really quickly what that is, what that would look like?
Yes. If you have a special needs student, as you know, oftentimes public schools don't have the staff or the resources to provide an appropriate education for special needs kids.
Right.
Special needs parents know these difficulties all too well. And what North Carolina wants to do is basically what five other states have done, is provide basically an account where parents can use money in that account to get what they believe would be an appropriate education for their child, whether that be in a private school, and they can use the money in that account for either private school tuition, for medical therapies, for testing, tutoring, things like that. Programs that have proven very popular in other states that we'd like to bring to North Carolina, and we think once passed would grow immensely because of the popularity.
That's incredible.
Yes. So we hope that the Senate provision stays in and that North Carolina parents of special needs students will have this option.
I hope they do. All right. Well, thanks for highlighting some of these, Bob.
It's good to be here, Demi.
The Civitas Institute Conservative Leadership Conference is June 16th and 17th. Nigel Farage, leader of the UK Independence Party in the face of Brexit, will headline this year's event. Incredible speakers, noted policy experts, and conservative leaders from across the country will come together to educate, equip, and inspire you to stand up for your freedoms. The 2017 Conservative Leadership Conference, June 16th and 17th at the Raleigh Marriott Crabtree Valley. Get details and tickets at civitasclc.com. That's CIVITASCLC.
Hello, I'm Jim Tynan from Civitas. I'm here with Susan Myrick, who's our election policies analyst, and we're going to talk about some left-wing groups are trying to intimidate ordinary citizens, partly through lawsuits that would deter reports of voter fraud. So, Susan, can you tell us a little bit more about how progressive political activists are trying to make criminals out of voters who just want to identify and prevent voter fraud?
Well, they're on a mission to do just that, using tactics that have worked in the past in North Carolina. If they succeed, they'll discourage honest citizens from filing protests and put more roadblocks up to detecting voter fraud. In the wake of the extremely close North Carolina 2016 gubernatorial election, hundreds of protests were filed by voters pointing out irregularities in voting, including in absentee balloting, and ineligible voters, dead voters, and voters who were active felons. All the protests in 2016 were filed by citizens residing in the county where they alleged election irregularity occurred. Some of these protests had input and assistance from the McCrory campaign. As in the case with protests in every election, some of the protests were dismissed for various reasons, including lack of evidence and even technicalities. But some of the protests were upheld and revealed voter fraud and serious voting irregularities.
Susan, one thing I was very interested in reading from your recent articles is that it's the voters of the state who are solely responsible for identifying what they think is election and voting problems and fraud. In fact, votings are the only ones that are allowed by state law to file election protests and challenges. And it's important, I guess, for us to remember that an ordinary citizen who files a complaint is the first line of defense against voter fraud in North Carolina, and that citizen will ultimately act as a prosecutor in a quasi-judicial realm.
That's right. It is up to the citizens. And in November, while North Carolina citizens thought they were doing their duty, acting as sentinels, guarding election integrity, Democracy North Carolina, a very left-wing activist group, and its leader and lobbyist, Bob Hall, have tried to paint these citizens as being part of a criminal scheme concocted by McCrory's campaign. Using a dubious report as a prop, Bob Hall has called for a criminal investigation into the McCrory campaign for daring to question possible wrongdoing. This is not surprising, after all. Democracy North Carolina is a progressive activist organization, as I said, and a Blueprint NC member.
And just to put that in perspective, Blueprint NC is the group responsible for passing out a strategy memo just weeks after Pat McCrory took office as governor in 2013. Taking explicit aim at McCrory, the memo directed Blueprint members to, among other things, attack the Republican leaders, quote, crippling their leaders, Governor McCrory, House Speaker Tillis, Senate President Berger, quote, eviscerate the leadership and weaken their ability to govern, unquote, quote, pressure McCrory at every public event, unquote. And the Blueprint NC memo also called for the use of private investigators in investigative reporting, especially in the executive branch.
It's amazing that these directions can be given to people actually in North Carolina. It seems so far-fetched. But Bob Hall has made a living off of producing questionable reports, as the one he has written after the November 2016 election, and providing statistics, even if the numbers are skewed or concocted. And what happens with these reports is that the political left wing uses them in their lawsuit of the day. In the latest Democracy NC report, Hall focuses on protests in only 23 counties, and he selectively tells stories of some people who were included in the protests. It is interesting to know, in his report, while Hall implies that people who file election protests may be criminals, he also suggests that people who do commit voter fraud do so merely by accident or out of ignorance of the voting rules. In other words, Jim, when it comes to voter fraud in North Carolina, people, Bob Hall says, people who report what they think is a crime are criminals, while those who commit a crime are just mistaken. Bob Hall's latest report is immediately discredited because it includes 257 protests over absentee ballots from Bladen County. You may have heard of this. This was a big story after the election. Some people called it a ballot mill. An absentee ballot mill in Bladen County. But the 257 protests were nearly half of the protests that Bob Hall claims were unsubstantiated. Bob Hall blatantly and purposefully misleads anyone reading the report by claiming all 257 protests in Bladen County were dismissed for lack of evidence. In fact, and in truth, which Bob Hall fails to mention in his report, is that the board, the State Board of Elections, unanimously voted to send this voter fraud case to the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District for further investigation.
In other words, nearly half of the protests Democracy NC attacks in its report were mischaracterized in that report by Bob Hall. And that's understandable from their point of view. 600 sounds a lot more despicable than 300. But knowing that Bob Hall and Democracy NC will lie so blatantly about half the cases in the so-called report, what else would we find to be false if we took time to really research these accusations?
And where do we expect to see this report to turn up in the left lawsuit circuit in North Carolina? In fact, there is a lawsuit brewing in Guilford County where four of the nine Guilford County voters named in an election protest petition filed a defamation lawsuit against the voter who brought the petition to the court. Their lawyers will no doubt point to Democracy North Carolina's report as if it is a scientifically approved research. And to no one's surprise, the activist organization, another one, Jim, Southern Coalition for Social Justice, is representing those voters. The Southern Coalition for Social Justice in recent years has taken the lead in lawsuits suing the state of North Carolina in things such as election reform, voter ID, and redistricting. In fact, the Southern Coalition for Social Justice executive director, Anita Earls, was a member of the State Board of Elections until her group decided to sue the state over redistricting in 2011. Lawsuits have become weapons for the progressive left in efforts to rewrite law without bothering about a vote of the legislature. This is very handy when Democrats are out of power. The left has an uncanny way of using lawsuits to add credibility to their accusations. And even though the Southern Coalition for Social Justice must know that the individual who filed the election protest in Guilford County followed North Carolina law, the group filed the lawsuit against him to bring about a change to election law to keep people from bringing election protests. Their intimidation tactics could put a stop to most, if not all, election protests. After all, if filing a complaint means you will be automatically involved in the expensive and time-consuming business of defending yourself in court, citizens will be deterred from acting.
So, Susan, it sounds like this lawsuit might be what is called a slap suit. That's a strategic lawsuit against public participation, and it's meant to intimidate or censor the so-called opposition. Wikipedia puts it this way. A strategic lawsuit against public participation, a slap suit, is a lawsuit that is intended to censor, intimidate, and silence critics by burdening them with the cost of a legal defense until they abandon their criticism or opposition. Such lawsuits have been made illegal in many jurisdictions on the ground that they impede freedom of speech. The typical slap plaintiff does not normally expect to win the lawsuit. The plaintiff's goals, rather, are accomplished if the defendant succumbs to fear, intimidation, mounting legal costs, or simple exhaustion and abandons the criticism.
Jim, the current North Carolina statutes governing election protests are sufficient. The laws are clear and detailed where protests are concerned. Current law lays out responsibilities not only for the protester, but also for the County Board of Elections and the State Board as well. Those laws provide safeguards to protect honest voters. Many election protests don't ever get beyond the county's preliminary hearing, and most don't move beyond the full hearing of county BOE, which is by design. Only the most serious and well-supported cases of voter misconduct or fraud should go to a full hearing. Democracy North Carolina and the Southern Coalition for Social Justice are attempting to change rules regarding elections protests to further their mission of doing away with any vestige of accountability in elections in North Carolina. One thing we know for sure, an election protest is not a crime, and a citizen of the United States should not be threatened, bullied, or intimidated for performing his or her civic duty.
Thank you, Susan, for this analysis of what's really going on in the election process. For our listeners, if you'd like more information about election or voting laws and developments or any other top topics in the world today, please check out our website at nccivitas.org.
The Civitas Institute Conservative Leadership Conference is June 16th and 17th. Nigel Farage, leader of the UK Independence Party in the face of Brexit, will headline this year's event. Incredible speakers, noted policy experts, and conservative leaders from across the country will come together to educate, equip, and inspire you to stand up for your freedoms. The 2017 Conservative Leadership Conference, June 16th and 17th at the Raleigh Marriott Crabtree Valley. Get details and tickets at civitasclc.com. That's CIVITASCLC.
This is Demi Dowdy with the Civitas Institute, and each week I'll be giving you the Media Meltdown Minute. Every week we'll be talking about the media, how they've dropped the ball, how they've misreported, and gotten the facts wrong. Earlier this week, comedian and actress Kathy Griffin, also an anchor on CNN on New Year's Eve, received backlash when she was portrayed in a photo shoot holding President Trump's bloodied head, kind of in the form of ISIS. So did the media react? Did the media give any backlash to Kathy Griffin? Actually, the public outcry was all that I heard. In the media, the reaction really was, wow, we have better things to worry about than Kathy Griffin and her maybe tasteless art. Unfortunately, I don't think that's good enough. It was violent, it was abhorrent, and her actions have pushed down the line what we call decent as a society. Thankfully, some in the conservative media have given accurate criticism and the Secret Service has begun investigations. So when the media is so disconnected from reality and from the seriousness of these statements, it is abhorrent. And those of us who don't trust the media already take them far less seriously.
Thank you to Demi Dowdy for that media meltdown, and thank you for listening to this episode of What Matters in North Carolina. We look forward to talking to you next week and continuing to tell you the things that matter to you in North Carolina.